You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Today I'm joined in the studio by an Ashland author whose life has been defined by the fortress of military culture and the liberation of the written word. Please bear with me as I squeeze her life of enormous accomplishments into a brief introduction. Molly Bess Tinsley is a woman of remarkable transitions. She's a self-described, quote, Air Force brat, end quote, who lived in occupied Japan and Germany. She went on to serve for 20 years on the civilian faculty of the U.S. Naval Academy, becoming the institution's first professor emerita. In what she describes as a, quote, fit of sanity, end quote, she resigned from the academy to move west and dedicate herself to the writing full time. Her career is a masterclass in versatility. It spans literary fiction, spy thrillers, memoirs, middle grade novels, and textbooks. Molly's excellence has been recognized with two National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships and the Oregon Book Award. She's also helped shape the industry as a co-founder of Fuse Publishing. Molly is also a longtime arts columnist, including contributions to the monthly journal here at JPR. Today, we're sitting with Molly Bess Tinsley to discuss her storied career and her latest novel, A Modest Trumpet Fanfare, which examines the private fractures within the disciplined facade of a family navigating military life. Molly, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Wow. Thank you for having me. I just have to say I had forgotten a lot of that stuff, Mike. Thank you for reminding me.
Well, you certainly have had a storied career. Now, let's begin, though, with your latest novel, A Modest Trumpet Fanfare. Now, I was 8 chapters in before I understood the title. Tell me about it.
Well, the title is actually based on a line in the novel, and it's one that is written by the main character. It's a little bit hard. I have to back up just for a minute to say that this novel actually happens as the result of 5 different voices. And her voice is the central one. And we are in her voice when she happens to mention A Modest Trumpet Fanfare as a way of commemorating the fact that she has a full scholarship to a women's college majoring in theater. This theater major is involved in for 2 or 3 years, has her starring in musical comedies, musical theater, I should say. And then it's aborted when she meets somebody from the Air Force Academy at a mixer and marries and has twins and et cetera.
Well, you use the image of a fortress to describe military life, something that is both protective but also isolating. How did your own upbringing shape this perspective?
Well, it took me a long time to realize that it had, that it does mean that you're growing up in a kind of a box. My father was a meteorologist, so he was not super military, but it doesn't matter. The military culture invades one way or another because of things like rank, the absoluteness of rank. It is rigidly hierarchical. Families are assumed to be hierarchical. I can remember my father saying a million times, I'm the boss in this family. And I would rebel and say, no, you're not. And I suppose with a different father, that might have been very serious offense. It wasn't in our family. I was fortunate. But around me, I saw lots of boxes.
When you say boxes, you're talking about moving a lot.
Well, yeah, the box image comes over and over again. Yes, we are always putting our things into boxes. Our homes go into boxes. We never do put down roots. We're just always moving in boxes. And the restraints, the rules, the idea that any break of the rules is super important. It's a real crisis. It can impact on your father's career. If he can't lead his family, how is he going to lead his men?
So the father is in the military, but so is the entire family.
Yes, exactly. And that's actually, I think, behind the little catchphrase that the Department of Defense came up with finally in 2016, I think, families serve too. They really do. And just to jump ahead, wars don't ever end. I mean, they don't stay at the office. Conflict, violence, weaponry, we, they thinking, having an enemy, doesn't stay at the office. It comes home and it invades the family and it colors the family. And that's the point I'm trying to actually illustrate by following a family from World War II up to 2019, 3 generations.
Oh, that's quite a feat. Yeah. Your novel follows Ted and Marina Diamond as they try to build the perfect military family. Why was it important for you to explore the divide between outward composure and inner emotional reality?
Oh, I grew up with that. I mean, that was really the unspoken doctrine of the family. It wasn't even unspoken a lot of times. There was very much a sense that we may have been living inside a fortress if we lived on base, but the family itself was a mini fortress, and nothing went outside the family. If my father cracked a joke about somebody he was working with, he would always say, "This doesn't go out of the family." And we had very much a sense, I'm not sure if you've come to that scene in my book, but it was so typical that my dad would be on the phone sort of laughing it up, and, you know, he called himself Willie Best to be folksy, you know, with people that were working for him. And then he'd turn around and he'd roll his eyes to the family. You know, you just had the feeling that, yes, you put your best foot forward, but it was always a performance. That's the word.
Game.
It's always performance.
And there's this rigid chain of command.
Very much.
If you break the chain of command, there are consequences.
That's true.
Even for the family.
Yeah.
So the book spans, as you said, three generations, 80-year timeline. Talk about the process of mapping American military and cultural history into this intimate family story.
Well, in a sense, it wasn't difficult. I understood that the beginning was going to be at the armistice. And after that, it was very easy to find a war to attach to from then on. I mean, we're basically always at war. And look at us now. We have an addiction to it.
That's very true. I spent 12 years in the military, and you're right. We were always at war. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange. My guest is Molly Best Tinsley, author of the novel A Modest Trumpet Fanfare. So, Molly, why did you write this book?
I should be able to answer that question very easily, but it's a complicated thing. It began with a scene that came to me during the pandemic that I'd been sort of working over in my mind before I went to sleep, that kind of thing, for a couple of years. And I finally decided to sit down and write the scene. I had not been present at the scene. Somehow I needed to get it out of my system. And once that scene was written, it began to spawn two characters. The other characters began to step out of the woodwork. And I had a family, essentially. I had a mother, a father, and two kids, twins. And it really wasn't for maybe a year or so into the writing of the book that the fifth person actually appeared. And he is the grandson of the original couple.
How long had you been writing the book at that time?
A long time. 4 years, maybe. In fits and starts, but then once it finally got going, it was my companion day after day. I miss it terribly now. I really do. I mean, having to do all this other kind of thing. I mean, I enjoy talking to you, but there are other things that are just much more fraught, let's say. And I'd rather be writing.
So this book took you years to complete.
That's correct.
Did you ever think at some point, I'm never going to get this done?
Not really. I mean, I think there was a piece of me that would have been content with that. I think I would have been content to live in that world because it made so much sense to me. There were a lot of dire things that went on, but it made sense. It reflected my worldview. When I speak my worldview out in the real world, I usually get told to stop ranting. You know, I lighten up.
Well, it sounds like it's therapeutic.
Pardon?
It sounds like it's therapeutic.
It has been therapeutic. It has been.
Well, you spent two decades teaching honors English and creative writing to midshipmen. How did that environment, which prioritizes collective identity, influence your personal view of the re-education that happens within military structures?
Well, it is not malignant, let's put it that way. It is not bad. For one thing, the bottom line for the midshipmen is usually small town, large family. So they're getting a quality education and they're getting a start in life that they might not have gotten otherwise, the bright ones. So that part is okay. As long as they understand what's going on, that they are actually being broken down in their plebe year in order to build back a military officer. And many of them do. Many of them are that smart. And we did have an English major at the Naval Academy.
Go ahead, tell me about it.
I was one of the big recruiters there. You might be able to appreciate that as a recruiter. I spoke the doctrine, you know, about language, about creativity, about right brain being as important as left brain in any pursuit. And they were receptive. We had a good batch of English majors, and oftentimes they were at the top of the heap in terms of grades. They were really smart because they were not only excelling in English, in language, in that sort of that kind of thinking, but they were also acing their engineering classes, you know, systems and mechanical engineering and chemical engineering. I mean, they were smart kids and a pleasure to work with.
I remember those years. There's a competition. Just like athletes have competitions on the field and on the court, in the classroom, there is a competition.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And some of them are very pushy about insisting on their excellence. But they were good kids. They really were. I have to say I enjoyed working with them because I knew where they were coming from and I knew how to get to them.
Okay, so you were there 20 years and then you left.
That is correct. I'd had enough and I was writing more and more and I just really wanted the time to write.
And you chose Oregon. Why?
The festival.
Are you kidding me? The Oregon Shakespeare Festival?
Absolutely. I'm a play nut. I don't go to films, but I'll go to a play. Well, I've seen a couple of the plays already twice. And my record was Enter the Guardsman after I first got here. I saw that. That's a very silly but wonderful musical, and I saw it 6 times.
Okay.
And whenever I wrote a play review, I would always see the play at least twice to see how it was working, what the director was doing, what the director's take was on the material, and what he was actually getting or she was getting us to see. It's all so complicated, and it's miraculous, the theater. It really is.
It's magical.
It is magic. It's absolute magic, yeah.
And so you're writing reviews for plays.
Yeah.
That you added to your repertoire. What's your favorite kind of writing?
Fiction. Fiction narrative. Yeah. I like writing dialogue, though. And for about 10 years, I actually was writing plays here, and I had a couple of them produced. One was produced in Seattle and was very well received, but, you know, it's impossible to do anything, really, without pushing. And playwriting is difficult to implement because you have to travel a lot to enter play contests and to get the actors workshopping your play before it can ever be on the stage.
And what's the difference in time that it takes you to push out a novel versus a play?
Oh, I think a play would be shorter, for sure, to get the first draft, yeah, because the play just, it kind of, you generate too much, and then it's a matter of cutting and shaping, whereas the novel, you have to furnish everything, you know, the setting, the historical context, and you have, as a narrator, you either have to do it yourself as a narrator, or you have to figure out ways to have your characters do it.
Well, your characters were very smart. I mean, the kind of dialogue, it just pulls you in because it's succinct, it's crisp, it's witty, it's direct, and the message, sometimes there's double entendre.
Thank you. That's all I can say is thank you. I love writing dialogue, and I'm glad that it affected you, that you felt impacted by it, you know.
So what's next?
Well, I hope I'd like to work on another novel, but I think I might actually do more short fiction. I've done it. There also is a new genre called flash fiction, which is stories under 1,000. I had a story in something called Clackamas Literary Review up in Portland, and you can do it quickly, I guess. It's not easy to pack a story into 1,000 words or 800 words. But I think really I would like to just do another novel, make the commitment, create the world, be inside it.
So you just decide and then you
Well, first I have to see what comes out. I have little notes to myself all over the place on, you know, the proverbial grocery list and whatever. I just, when I get an idea at night, you know, scrawl it somewhere. I need to collect all those scraps of paper and see what I've got.
Okay, we're going to dig into that after the break. We'll return shortly with my guest, Molly Bess Tinsley, author of the novel A Modest Trumpet Fanfare. I'm Mike Green. As a professor of writing, she taught for 20 years at the Naval Academy, becoming the institution's first professor emerita. She resigned from the academy to move west and dedicate herself to writing full-time. That dedication produced multiple books and awards. Molly, you once said that, quote, narrative is an instrument for making truths concrete, end quote. How has your goal as a writer evolved from your first novel, My Life with Darwin, to your work today?
I think the craft has evolved, and maybe more of an ability to do something subtle has evolved. I think it's become more granular. Maybe that's the word that I can use. I'm more able to actually inhabit the world that I've created rather than remain outside it and keep some distance. And that may have actually reached its summit with A Modest Trumpet Fanfare because I really did live that world. The other worlds are more or less invented.
So your writing actually pulled you in, just like it does the reader.
Yeah, it does. It does, and that's why what I call the recursive process is so important, the revisions, because you write a draft, then you enter that draft, and you look around, and you see what you missed the first time, so you add a detail. And when this is a particularly lively detail, all of a sudden it affects what happens afterwards, so you have to revise that. You know, it's that butterfly effect kind of over and over again. And that's how you stay in that world forever, you know, just going in and finding a little dust in the corner and putting it there, and then, what does that mean?
So you go where your inclinations and your inspiration leads you. You don't have a predetermined destination.
That is right. I don't. And that is that is one of my main crusades now, is that I feel as though my kind of writing is falling out of favor, definitely out of favor. I want to give you some statistics. I looked at the catalog for the Willamette Writers Conference in Portland this summer. They're offering 33 workshops. Of those workshops, three have to do with the imagination, which is what I would call the right brain functions. And they're all connected to poetry. They're all poetry workshops.
That's surprising to me.
Then four are actually, or maybe I've got this wrong, six maybe. I think it's three and then six, are about matters of craft, which are important too, but not by themselves. I mean, genre is a matter of craft, plot, character, point of view, but there has to be some life that you're working with, right?
It can't all just be mechanics.
That's right. It can't all be mechanics. There are the remaining 20 workshops have to do with navigating the, quote, industry. Okay? They're about industry professionals, types of publishing, building a book deal, agents, over and over again, disciplined, building your brand. I hate that idea that I have a brand. It nauseates me. But anyway, these are my two most unfavorites. One was how to make it to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Can you imagine starting out a work or even being in the middle of the work with that goal?
That is amazing.
This is worse. Some guy has come forward and he's going to give a workshop on a proven system to stay disciplined, results driven. That's where it's going.
So where's the creativity?
It's gone. It's gone. And I think people have their eyes on the clock. They have their eyes on money. They want the book deal. We're into that syndrome, which does happen, which is if you have a financial success, you just want to do it over and over again, or even a popular success. It's more the popularity, I think, than the money in that case. It's just, they loved me for that. I'm going to do it again and again and again.
How did that affect you?
I just didn't have that kind of book. I mean, I think that it literally did affect me. My Life with Darwin was not a bestseller. It was my first novel. It was my debut novel. This happens to a lot of first novelists. And as a result, when I had a story collection and tried to publish it with Houghton Mifflin, they weren't interested. So I took the story collection and I submitted it to a couple of contests around the country, and it actually won the Ohio State Press contest called the Sandstone Prize, and that's the book that won the Oregon Book Award, a collection of short stories. But after that, I was pretty dead in the water in terms of mainstream publishing. I didn't have a money-making record.
Well, your bibliography is incredibly diverse. I mean, it ranges from the Victorian Pierce spy thrillers to your memoir, Entering the Blue Stone. Do you find that certain truths can only be told through specific genres?
The geopolitical truth was fun to explore in the two spy thrillers. I'll just put it that way. I'm not sure that a real expert in those fields would agree with my presentation of Ukraine and Sudan. Those are the two locations for the spy thrillers. And that's a hard question to answer, actually. I think I was more interested in the idea of almost a conspiracy theory type of thing with geopolitics. And also, my co-author for the first one had worked at the CIA as a consultant. She was my friend of mine from the East Coast. And that first spy novel was her idea. And when she told me she was going to try to write it, I figured I better get on board because I was going to have to do it anyway, because she was going to be sending me things and I was going to have to read them. So we did it together. And then I branched off and did one more because I enjoyed the sort of secrecy and double, well, it's again what you grow up with. You know, there is the surface reality and then there's what's really going on. And it allowed me to explore that, I think.
Do you think that there are some conspiracies that are real?
Probably, just because reality is big. But I'm not an advocate for any particular conspiracy. I'm sure that the news we get through mainstream media is not accurate. And I do think the legacy media has more and more been compromised by business, by the business sector. I think business rules is what it is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Molly Bess Tinsley, author of the novel A Modest Trumpet Fanfare. Molly, your middle school novel, Behind the Waterfall, was a collaboration with your twin grandsons.
That's correct.
Tell me about that experience.
Well, it was pretty delightful, and it happened because they live back east, and they were 8 years old, maybe, and they were complaining that there were no books in the library about twins. So I said, okay, we're going to write one. And we did. I had a little bit of trouble, technically, with the idea of twins. They were going to be different, of course, but not different enough to really create some tension. And I was reading the opening chapters to their cousin, my granddaughter, who was an avid reader. I mean, she was reading The Lord of the Rings at seven. So I thought she would be a good critic. And she listened to me as I read them out loud. And then she said, well, I think that's all just good, Lola. That's what she called me. But I think they need a sister. And so the third character was born, the sister for the twins, and she became the narrator. And it was perfect. That's what I love about that book. She was stepped in and began to tell the story of these two brothers. And that gave the tension because she was the kid sister who was always sneaking along and getting in the back of the truck when they didn't notice, that type of thing. And she's also a bit tongue-in-cheek all the time. I mean, she loves them, but, sister and brother, it was fun. It was fun.
That makes the dialogue titillating.
Yes, it does. And it also kept all three grandchildren happy.
Well, your collection, Throwing Knives, won an award. Tell me about that.
That's the one that I submitted myself to the Ohio State University Press for their Sandstone Prize. And what I have learned, and I think I learned it through this, is that prizes are awarded depending on who the judge is. And the judge in that case, Rosellen Brown, I think that's her name. It's been a while. She was my age. She was literary fiction. She was female, And I think that was probably what tipped it finally into winning. And then when it was submitted to the Oregon Book Award, we had Dorothy. She wrote Bastard Out of Carolina. So she was not a happy, happy kind of person, and she understood my characters. And so she gave me the award. I'm sure that was a huge factor.
Okay, so your characters had some sort of resonance with the judges.
Right. That's what I feel. Dorothy Allison, I think her name is.
You co-founded Fuse Publishing and ran it for 13 years before it closed in 2022. What did that experience teach you?
Oh, how difficult publishing is. It'll take all your money. The marketing part, you know, you have to buy everything. It's just worse now. But I'm very happy to have brought out the books that we brought out. I really am. There are a couple of them that have won prizes, and they were good books.
Well, now we have digital platforms like Amazon and others. And the industry has been turned on its head, topsy-turvy. There's a lot of chaos in the industry, and authors have a difficult time figuring out the paths that they need to travel.
That's correct, yeah.
What would you say to a new author that is navigating the seas of AI, the seas of digital platforms, and the shorter and shorter attention spans of the American reader?
I don't have anything particularly positive to say that to that person, except that writing is its own reward, really. I don't have any advice on that, because I feel as though we have a culture that is descending into illiteracy, basically. I mean, that's over a long haul, but we're going in that direction. We're not going in the direction of more and more literature majors. I mean, the thing that drove me into English was just loving the literature that I had read in college. You know, the great books. Granted, it was all white stuff at the time, and but that just makes it richer now. I mean, we now can reach out and find all kinds of literatures, not just the dead white male kind. But they're, you know, some of the elite kids are studying that, but basically nobody's that interested, I don't think.
Well, what are your thoughts about our society's addictive personality and the erosion of literacy?
Well, I think you just made the connection right there. I mean, literacy, if reading as an addiction, is fairly complicated. And it probably became simpler with things like reading online and Kindle. And just the whole dynamic physiology of reading. I've read studies that reading on a screen is very different than reading on a page. Mm-hmm. And I know that for a fact. I never counted on looking at a final draft online on the screen. I always print it out, and I see all kinds of things I missed.
Well, your latest novel, A Modest Trumpet Fanfare, is published by a press that focuses on women over 50. So how has your age expanded your ability to, as your character says, quote, say yes and no in one breath?
I love that you have cited that sentence, because that's huge. It really is. I mean, that takes you right back to Keats's negative capability, the ability to hold doubts and uncertainties in your mind without resolving them. It's both ands. The idea of a holistic reality, I guess. And that's one of my favorite sentences. It kind of runs through the book, actually, that theme of yes and no in the same breath.
And this is the final question, since we're running out of time. What do you hope to achieve with this book for the reader?
An understanding, maybe, of the brat culture. And probably, I think of this as an anti-war book in a very subtle way. And I think if people can see that war is not something that happens overseas, that it's happening around you, that there are people in your community They have no community of their own. That's the other fact of life. I mean, no matter what they say, you are a family that's kind of floating on the surface of the country. And it's that. That's not healthy. And at the moment, there are 5 million brat children.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Molly.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate this conversation.
My guest was Molly Bess Tinsley, author of the novel A Modest Trumpet Fanfare. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.